The testimony of the Gospels, supposed chronological discrepancies, supposed variation in quotation that would supposedly, again, make the Gospels unreliable. Tonight, I want to take up one, and we'll probably spend on it all night. Next week, we'll get to the external evidences, things outside of the Bible, outside of the Gospels, which testify to the reliability. But there's one last one that may be the big kahuna in our time, and that's miracles. This is a major reason why some reject the Gospels. Peter J. Williams is a British scholar. He's written a book entitled, Can We Trust the Gospels? Apart from the Bible, that's probably going to be the only book I'm going to recommend. But if you're looking for a book on this type of material, I can highly recommend it. It's not super long, and it's very measured and reasonable. He doesn't go beyond the evidence. He handles it very well. I've had the opportunity of emailing with this gentleman a couple different times. He makes this statement in one of the things he wrote. Were it not for the many miraculous reports in the Gospels, most historians would be very happy to treat their accounts as generally historically reliable. You hear what he's saying? In his experience in the scholarly world, most historians would take the Gospels at face value and view them as generally historically reliable, but the Gospels are a deal breaker for them. And because of that, the miracles, pardon me, are a deal breaker. And because of that, they reject everything else. But he says in itself, this is no small thing because it's a testament to the fact that apart from the miracles, even in these people's minds, the Gospels look like credible history. Objections concerning the miracles come in various forms. Some will make what they might call a scientific objection, which runs as follows. The discovery of the natural physical laws by which the universe operates has proven. In other words, we've got all these scientific discoveries we've made in the past 2,000 years, particularly the past 200 years. And these prove to us that miracles are not possible. The idea of a virgin birth and a resurrection, these things took root in a pre-scientific world. In light of the scientific discoveries we've made, we now know that those miracles are impossible. What do you think? Again, I'm always saying this, and I probably shouldn't say it, but I mean, if you're anything like me, which woe is you if you are, but I hear things sometimes, and it'll set me back on my heels, and I think, okay, you know, that kind of has the sound of authority and truth, but does that objection really make any sense? It really doesn't, because, for example, 2,000 years ago, they didn't have all the scientific knowledge that we have, but did they know that it took a man and a woman to make a child? Did they know that when someone died, there was going to be a funeral and that person wasn't coming back this side of Jordan? They knew those things just as surely as we do. They knew what was natural, and it's because they knew what was natural that when something unnatural happened, they looked at it and said, this goes so far beyond what's natural, this must have been supernatural. So science has nothing to do with it. We are no more sure of those basic things than they were 2,000 years ago. Many of the objections we encounter on this really are rooted in an assumption. An atheistic, materialist assumption that Carl Sagan really put memorably in 1980. He said this, the universe is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. In other words, the only thing that exists is the material world. You are asking me, they'll say to us, or in essence, you're asking me to believe in something that is outside of this material world, but this is all I see, this is all I have quote-unquote evidence for, it's all I'm experiencing, hence this is all there is. And you know, if someone is committed to that point of view, committed, you're probably not going to be able to sway them, in my experience. Cam and I were doing some canvassing over by the Murray Road Meeting House last summer. And we got to speak with a gentleman who was older than Cam, younger than me. He's an atheist. And as we were engaging him in conversation, I asked him eventually, I said, is there anything that would convince you there is a God? And he goes, I can't think of what it would be. I said, you know, if the stars were to align, this is God, this is me, would you believe in God? No. So it was interesting. He'd put a bar here that had to be overcome that really was not realistic. The thing is, the idea that the physical world is all there is an assumption. Unless you can prove there is no God, miracles are a possibility, at the very least. Logically speaking, they are a possibility. There's no logical reason why they would not be. And there's a whole lot we could say about that whole atheism thing, and I'll just say one thing. The prevailing conclusion in the scientific world today is that the universe had a beginning. If you read books on this subject, that's where cosmologists are at now. The universe did have a beginning, and it began when the Big Bang occurred. And most people, when they think of the Big Bang, they think of, okay, there was this thing called the singularity, and it exploded into space and expanded. But that's not what the theory of the Big Bang teaches. The Big Bang says that what you had there was everything, time, space, and matter. And it wasn't till the explosion that time actually began. And space, with inflation, as this space was created. So time, space, and matter, according to science, began. Now, matter cannot account for its own existence because there was no matter from which this matter came. So where did the matter come from? There was nothing, and then there was something. Now, we know nothing times nothing equals nothing. So apparently there was something in addition to the nothing. And that something was timeless because there was no time yet. It did not occupy three-dimensional space because three-dimensional space did not exist yet. And it was not material because there was no matter yet. And furthermore, it must have been intelligent because the universe bears signs of incredible order. In fact, my understanding is that many physicists, for them, even though they may not believe, that is the most compelling argument. When they look at the fine-tuned nature of the universe, they're like, it really does look like somebody kind of monkeyed with physics and made all this work. So we have evidence there is a God. If I'm going to follow the facts, I've got to at least be willing to acknowledge, yes, there is a possibility there's a God. And if there's a possibility there's a God, there's a possibility of miracles. Jeff Yost and I were doing some canvassing in Raytown. We encountered a young man who looked like John Mayer, if you know who that is. I mean, he really looked like him. We talked for about 45 minutes. And we talked about a lot of things. We talked about evolution and so forth. We just went from one topic to another. And finally, toward the end of the conversation, he looked at me and he said, but what about the resurrection? And what he was saying to me was that he was basically saying, look, these things don't happen. People don't rise from the dead. How can you expect me to believe this? How do you explain this? And again, what's the assumption in that question? People don't rise from the dead. People never have risen from the dead. Says who? What's that assumption rooted in? When someone says, people don't rise from the dead, what are they basing that on? Experience. They're basing that on their own experience and on the experience of those they know. Is experience the only way to arrive at truth? We know better than that. There's a whole bunch of things we believe that we have zero experience with. And there's a whole bunch of history we believe that we had no experience with. We believe it because of testimony. I'll come back to that. David Hume was an 18th century Scottish philosopher, and I am bringing him up in part because it's been said that our culture suffers from a Hume hangover. This is what David Hume taught. He taught, if you're going to believe in something, it has to be probable. And something is probable only if it conforms, quote, to humanity's uniform and consistent experience. Now, file that away. Humanity's uniform and consistent experience. Miracles fall outside of humanity's uniform and consistent experience. Therefore, they are improbable, and therefore they're not worthy of belief, which is really what these people are arguing, even though they may not think of it in those terms. But I like this saying that comes from philosophy, what proves too much proves nothing. And that view of things proves way too much. In 1817, there was a gentleman by the name of Richard Whately who took Hume's philosophy and he said, okay, I'm going to take this viewpoint that a thing is only worthy of belief if it's probable, and by probable, we mean it conforms to our consistent and uniform experience. So he looked at the life of Napoleon, a very unique historical figure. And he said, following Hume's method, following his philosophy, most of what, or at least much of what is in the life of Napoleon, cannot be believed because so much of it had never happened before and has never happened since. His life was really extremely unique in a multiplicity of ways. But of course, that conclusion is patently absurd because we have all the historical proof that he did exist and all those things really did happen. A Dr. Lawrence Burkholder, a man who'd been greatly influenced by Hume, he realized, once he came to the realization, he's like, you know, every historical event is to some extent, in some way unique. He said, I'm beginning to feel the limitations of Hume. That position takes you to places you do not want to go, and it assumes what it attempts to prove. And what do we call that? When you begin with your conclusion and then argue back to your conclusion, what's that called? Circular reasoning. And C.S. Lewis put it so well, as he so often did. He wrote, now, of course, we must agree with Hume that if there is absolutely uniform experience against miracles, if, in other words, they have never happened, why then they never have? Unfortunately, we know the experience against miracles to be uniform only if we know that all the reports of them are false. And we can know all the reports of them to be false only if we know already that miracles have never occurred. We are, in fact, arguing in a circle. Let me ask you. Let's go back 70 years, 80 years, 90 years. There's no genetic technology. Prove to me your mom and dad are your mom and dad. How are you going to do it? You're going to base it on testimony? And mom's going to say, I bore you, son. I know. Dad's going to say, I was there. I saw it. Brothers and sisters are going to say, I was standing out the door. I was listening. This hugely important fact so close to you, and the only way you know it's going to be someone, well, you're going to look like your parents. Well, not necessarily. Some of us do. Some of us don't. The only way you can know that a very important fact is testimony. We do not establish truth in history the same way we establish truth in science. There's no such thing as the historical, the scientific method in history. An enormous amount of what you and I believe and what people operate on is based on testimony. And we have it with the Gospels. To reject the testimony of the Gospels out of hand because they include miracles is to reject them not on historical grounds, not on scientific grounds, but on philosophical grounds. An assumption, an unproven assumption. And I'll just give us a taste, maybe, of the sorts of things we're going to be looking at next week. But when you look, for example, at the writings of Luke, of course, Luke wrote both Luke and Acts. We can look at the Greek vocabulary. We can look at the literary devices that are used, the literary style, pardon me. They're both written to the same individual. We know they were written by the same man. A gentleman by the name of Colin Hemer focused on just the last 16 chapters of Acts. And he went through them verse by verse. He's a historian. And he found in those just those last 16 chapters of Acts, 84 details that have been confirmed through historical and archaeological research. Confirmed. And if you've looked into that much, which I'm sure some of you have, you know that there are people who've looked at the book of Acts in the past and have said that Luke was not accurate in a number of details, only to have a discovery made later archaeologically. Oh, he actually was right about that. A gentleman by the name of William Ramsey, who wrote about the seven churches of Asia. Some of you may have that book. He was an archaeologist. He took some of his college students. They went over to the Mediterranean. They traveled from place to place, following at least some of the things in the book of Acts. He did not go as a believer. He went skeptical. Eventually, he became a believer. He said, Luke is among the best of historians. The same man who wrote that book of Acts wrote the Gospel of Luke. Just in the first three chapters of Luke, Luke mentions 12 political and religious leaders, all of whom have been confirmed in extra-biblical sources. Herod the Great, Caesar Augustus, Quirinius, Tiberius Caesar, Pontius Pilate, Herod, Herod the Tetrarch, Philip, Tetrarch of Iturea, Lysanias, Annas, Caiaphas, and John the Baptist. You know, if you are making up a story, you do not put it in historical crosshairs so that people who know history can vet it on that level. But Luke took the risk. Why did he do that? And he comes through with shining colors. See, here's the deal. That book of Acts, for example, it's got those 84 confirmed historical facts. In that very same book are 35 miracles. What logical reason? What logical reason? And we're talking to a skeptical friend, and you're not going to convince them overnight if they've got a heart that's open to it. We're just throwing things out for them to consider. But on what logical basis can I take someone who's so meticulous and so accurate that even archaeologists use his book today to guide their studies, but then as soon as he mentions this thing I have no experience with, I'm going to reject it? Where's the logic in that? To reject the Gospels out of hand also because of it's got miracles flies in the face of reason for other reasons than those we've discussed. Muhammad, according to the Quran, there are a few disputed passages, but it's generally acknowledged that the Quran does not claim any miracles for Muhammad, with the exception of the Quran itself. Now, later on, you have the Hadith, which came hundreds of years after Muhammad, which claimed miracles for him, but nothing from his time claimed miracles for him. In the case of the Gospels, all of them were written within the generation, the time of people who knew Jesus, who'd heard him, who watched him, are still living. And they all claim miracles. Why is that? And why is it that we have no first century testimony offering us a different explanation for his miracles? See, this is interesting. We have the Gospels. We have 1 Corinthians, which is written only about 20 years or so after Jesus' resurrection. Paul's claiming he resurrected. We have all these first century early witnesses saying, yes, Jesus performed miracles. We don't have a single, not even one, first century testimony saying, no, he was really a charlatan. The closest thing we have to it is the Jewish Talmud, which is almost certainly not coming from the first century, but it claimed that he was a sorcerer, which is not a denial of his miracles. It's only a denial of the source of the power. And how likely is it that the Christian movement took root right there in Jerusalem, which it did, based on this testimony that he rose from the dead, if in fact he didn't? Who would have believed it? How would Christianity have exploded like it did? What accounts for the explosion? From the very beginning, the Christian community has staked the whole validity of Christianity on the resurrection. You know, somebody once likened the death, burial, and resurrection to a gun. You can pull the hammer back, you can pull the trigger, but neither one of those things really has significance until the bullet is expelled from the barrel. And so also it is. Anybody can die, now not the way Jesus did, granted, but anybody can die, anybody can be buried. But when Jesus rose from the dead, this was a game changer. And he had appealed to it during his ministry. When he said there was a sin that no God will not forgive, they said, show us a sign to prove to us you can say a thing like this. And he said, I'm going to go into the heart of the earth 3 days, but only 3 days. When he overturned the tables of the money changers, they came to him and said, what sign do you show us that you do these things? And he said, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. Jesus was appealing to the resurrection from the beginning, and the gospel writers did, and Paul did early on. If the resurrection is false, Christianity is a farce. Notice what they have done. We're so used to this. Most religions are built on a philosophical system. They're built on ideas. Christianity is built on an historical event. It's made itself falsifiable, which means, as one brother put it, show me the bones of Jesus Christ and I'll reconsider my position. It says if you can demonstrate that this historical event, namely Jesus' resurrection, never happened, then what I believe in is false. Paul said it. If Christ is not risen, our preaching is empty. If Christ is not risen, your faith is futile. So many people have tried to explain the empty tomb and explain away the resurrection. What are some of those theories? Have we heard something? What are some of people's explanations? I know we're not having conversations like this every day, but these things are being said. The overwhelming majority of scholars 75%, liberal and conservative alike, acknowledge that there was an empty tomb. So we've got to explain this empty tomb. What's the explanation? Okay, that's one of them. Jesus didn't really die. He only appeared to die. We'll come back to that one. What's another one? The disciples stole the body, which goes all the way back to the first century. Yes? Another one? The swoon, yeah, that he just fainted. He really didn't die. Some have argued that the disciples hallucinated. Judging from their behavior afterward, it's evident they really did believe it. So what really happened was you had group hallucination. You had all these people who were so wrapped up in this, they believed they had seen Jesus risen from the dead, but in fact, he had not. Group hallucination does not happen. There is no evidence that group hallucination occurs, namely, where a bunch of people believe that they have seen a thing when there's nothing there, seen and feel a thing. If they're like dreams in that regard. You know, if a buddy of mine came to me, he's like, man, that was a great dream we had last night. Oh? Because I might have a dream, but I didn't have the same dream. When rare conditions exist, and some of us here have probably been in a room with someone who was hallucinating. That can be caused by chemicals, it can be caused by drugs, it can be caused by certain conditions. But you will not be hallucinating at the same time, or if you are, you will not be having the same hallucination. Gary Sibsey is a clinical psychologist, and he writes the following. I have surveyed the professional literature written by psychologists, psychiatrists, and other relevant healthcare professionals during the past two decades, and I have yet to find a single documented case of a group hallucination. That is, an event in which more than one person purportedly shared in a visual or other sensory perception where there was clearly no external referent. It hasn't happened. There's no evidence it's ever happened. Furthermore, what is the claim of the Gospels? And we'll go ahead and include 1 Corinthians, such as such early testimony. How many times did Jesus appear to somebody? Anybody ever counted those up? Just on the testimony, how many appearances were there of the resurrected Jesus? It's a nice biblical number. Take a guess. It's 12. 12 times. So here is the claim of the Gospels and including the book of Acts, that Jesus appeared on 12 separate occasions to over 517 people in a wide variety of contexts over a period of 40 days. He appeared to Mary Magdalene, the other Mary, two disciples on the road to Emmaus, the then 11 apostles, the over 500 brethren at once, to James, Jesus' brother, and then to Paul. And where did he appear? He appeared indoors and outdoors, in Judea and in Galilee, in town and in the countryside. He appeared in the morning. He appeared in the evening. He appeared by prior appointment and not by prior appointment. He appeared to groups of men and groups of women. He appeared close and distant. He appeared by a hill, by a lake. He appeared sitting, standing, walking, eating, and almost always, if not always, talking. The encounters we have are not these weird, nebulous encounters, you know, like the Loch Ness monster pictures and things like this. We're talking about close encounters where there are conversations. In four of the 12 appearances, Jesus is actually being touched. He's eating in their presence. On two other occasions, he offers to be touched. That would make six of the 12 in which there's physical engagement along with conversation and along with an extended appearance. This strains credulity. Oh, I'm supposed to believe that over 40 days, 517 plus people in all these different environments and all these different places in Judea and Galilee all had the same hallucination? And even if there were group hallucination, and even if the apostles had experienced it, that would not explain the empty tomb. That's the interesting thing. It seeks to explain the appearances, but it doesn't explain the empty tomb. Why is that tomb empty? And no matter how many hallucinations the disciples might have had, they never could have preached believably unless there were an empty tomb. No one would have believed it. If that body was still there and that tomb was still sealed, or if it was empty, if it was open and the body was still there, or they knew where the body was, it never would have worked. The group hallucination theory doesn't work. The wrong tomb theory doesn't work. This one, you know. The idea is that they came to the tomb, but it was the wrong tomb. They didn't know where Jesus was buried. He was actually buried over here. They came to this empty tomb. Oh, he's risen from the dead. How long would that have lasted? I mean, really? The Roman authorities knew where Jesus' body was. They'd put the soldiers there. The Jewish authorities certainly knew where it was. It was Joseph of Arimathea's tomb. Had they gone around saying Jesus was risen from the dead, people would have simply said, well, you need to go down another couple blocks and turn left. It's still there. It would never have lasted. The wrong tomb theory assumes that everyone had some kind of permanent kind of collective amnesia. We went all this time and all throughout the Roman Empire for a century, there were all these people believing that Jesus rose from the dead when his body was sitting there the whole time. It doesn't make any sense. And it tries to explain the tomb, but it doesn't explain the appearances. Did an empty tomb convince Saul of Tarsus that Jesus was risen from the dead? No, it was an appearance. It was an appearance. So we've got to explain both. There's the swoon or apparent death theory. Jesus didn't actually die on the cross, but he fainted. He only appeared to die. And by the way, that has happened, hasn't it? I mean, these things are not pleasant to talk about. The kids are downstairs, so I'll go ahead and say it. But, you know, we have unearthed, we've dug up these coffins, and they've got scratch marks on them where the people revived while they were in the coffin. It's a horrible thing to think about. So they say, well, this is what happened with Jesus. None of those people they found in the coffins, though, were crucified by Roman soldiers. Jesus' friends and his enemies both believed he was dead. His body was put into the hands of Joseph of Arimathea, and he and Nicodemus were so convinced he was dead, they got 100 pounds of aloes and spices, and they wrapped up his body, and they put him in a tomb. They had plenty of time to determine he was not dead. The centurion who was brought to Pilate, because Pilate couldn't believe that Jesus was dead already, he confirmed that. This man knew how to know if someone was dead. The Romans had these death squads, and that's what we have when Jesus is being crucified. They would have four Roman legionnaires, and they would have a centurion. And these men were specially trained to kill people. This was their job, part of their job. They would whip a man to the point of beat him within an inch of death. It was called the werboratio. That's what they called what they did to Jesus. There would be a post about yay high with a metal ring on it. The guy to be crucified would be chained to that, brought down on his knees. Can't move. And they would beat him. And the whip, of course, had those pieces of bone or metal on the end of it. It would just lacerate the back. Eusebius would write of the werboratio. Bystanders were struck with amazement when they saw them lacerated with scourges, even to the innermost veins and arteries, so that the hidden inward parts of the body, their bowels and their members, were exposed to view. And then they took him, made him walk all the way to Calvary, and then they took 6 or 7 inch nails and they drove it through his hands and through his feet. And then they plunged a spear into his side later. And the fact that blood and water poured from the wound shows that massive blood clotting had already taken place in the body, telling us he's dead. Roman soldiers knew how to kill a man and to know if he was dead. On March 21st, 1986, in the edition of the Journal of the American Medical Association, three medical doctors, one of them a pathologist from Mayo Clinic, wrote the following. Clearly, the weight of historical and medical evidence indicates that Jesus was dead before the wound to his side was inflicted. And it supports the traditional view that the spear probably perforated not only the right lung, but also the pericardium and heart, and thereby ensured his death. Accordingly, interpretations based on the assumption that Jesus did not die on the cross appear to be at odds with modern medical knowledge. But let's say, just for the sake of discussion, that really is what happened. That somehow these soldiers who were so skilled at killing people and they've run a spear into his side, somehow it was true that he actually fainted and that he was put into the tomb. How is a badly injured and bleeding man left to lie smothered in linens and spices in a cold, damp, dark tomb for multiple days without food and water? How's he going to survive? What's going to happen? He's going to bleed to death or he's going to die of some other cause? Well, let's say he somehow manages to. How then is he going to unwrap himself? 100 pounds of aloes and spices. He's got to unwrap himself. He's got to move this stone, which is probably around 2 tons. He's got to move that. He's got to somehow get past the Roman guards, which are guarding the tomb with his life. And then he's got to somehow convince the disciples that he triumphed over death. If they had seen him, what would they have concluded? Well, you might be alive, but you're not risen. Let's get you to a doctor. Furthermore, and this hints at next week, we have several non-Christian writers who affirm Josephus, Tacitus, Thallus, the Jewish Talmud, they affirm Jesus did die. It was understood in the first century that this man had been crucified and he had died. There was no swoon taking place. And what about the disciples stealing the body? Let me ask you. I'm doing all the talking here. What's the problem with that theory? The theory is that, yes, there was an empty tomb. What happened was the disciples came, they took the body, and then they claimed Jesus had raised from the dead. All right, we got two things here. So first of all, how did the disciples get past the Roman soldiers? Absolutely. And what was it you said, Steve?
Conviction preached into their own deaths.
Yes. You know, have people died for a lie? Sure they have. There were men who flew planes into the World Trade Center who died for a lie. Yes, Paul? Yeah, well, right. Although it would appear from something the lady said that Sunday morning that if you had multiple men, they probably could have moved it. But yeah, are the Roman soldiers going to let him do that? Yes, the conviction. Yes, you can find people who will die for a lie, but how many people have you ever known? Or how sensible is it that someone would die for a lie knowing it's a lie? And then you got to find 11 men who will do it, who will die for a lie, knowing a lie. All they have to do when they're getting ready to crucify Peter upside down, or they're getting ready to shoot, was it Thomas through with arrows? We have some traditions on how these men died. All they've got to do is say, no, it's all a lie. No, it's not true. They never did that. James was Jesus' brother. Josephus tells us he died for the faith. The high priest, while there was a power vacuum briefly in Palestine, had him stoned. Why did he do that? That doesn't fit. Well, it wasn't the disciples who stole the body. It was someone else. Someone else came and stole the body. And then the disciples innocently but erroneously concluded that Jesus had risen from the dead. Well, again, how are you going to get past the guards? And why did the tomb robbers take the corpse and leave the linen and spices, which were worth a whole lot of money, behind? And why did they take time to unwrap the body and then put the handkerchief over here? It doesn't add up. You know, what's Occam's razor? I know we're probably familiar with that. What's Occam's razor say? It's an old...
simplest explanation is best or most likely.
Yes. Generally speaking, the explanation that is most basic, that requires the fewest additional assumptions... that's the correct explanation. All these other theories require a whole bunch of extra assumptions to go beyond, well, maybe they did this, and there's this person who behaved this way. The easiest explanation, without preconceived ideas, and without an aversion to accepting it, is that it happened exactly as it said. You know, I don't know if I said this tonight. Sometimes I can't remember what things I say, but... somebody once said that an atheist can't find God for the same reason a thief can't find a police officer. And I think there's a lot of truth to that, generally speaking. That may not be true for everybody, but it's true for a lot. Sometimes we don't, most of the time, we don't believe, people reject these things because they don't want to believe them. There are other theories that are propounded. I don't think we need to take time with those. I'd like to mention one other thing before we move from the resurrection in the few minutes that we have left. And I'm going to bore you with a quote, but I'd like to read this to you. Skeptics rightfully put the burden of proof for the resurrection on Christians. In other words, they say, you're claiming that someone rose from the dead, so give us proof. That's fair. Christians need to put the burden of proof on skeptics for their alternate theories. In light of all the positive evidence for the resurrection, skeptics must offer positive first century evidence for their alternate views. Skeptics have formulated numerous alternate theories to explain away the resurrection, but there is no evidence from any first century source supporting any of them. Those who have alternate theories for the resurrection should be asked, and this is very fair, what evidence do you have for your theory? Can you please name three or four first century sources that support your theory? We have three or four first century sources that say, yes, he performed miracles, yes, he rose from the dead. They don't have even one first century source that attempts to explain those things away with any of these alternate theories. So who's got more evidence? I know that very few of us truly follow reason always to its logical conclusions. That's an unfortunate fact. God made us this way, so there must be a good reason. But emotion gets in the way. But when honest skeptics are presented with this question, they typically answer with silence or an admission that they have no such evidence because none exists. Any comments or questions on this material? Yes, Nancy. Peter J. Williams. He debated Bart Ehrman, if you're looking for something to watch on YouTube. Yes, Randy.
I spoke with a lady that was assured that she had an afterlife experience, that the life thing, it seems like people will accept that, or even be insulted if you don't accept that.
Yeah, oh yeah.
An afterlife or an out-of-body experience.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm,
right?
Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder about sorcery too, John. I think sorcery was very common in the time of Jesus. In fact, Paul ran into one very early in his ministry.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And, but this is never brought up as a possibility. You know? They, at one time, they tried to connect him to the other.
Yes. Yeah, and I think I mentioned it already, but we do have a Jewish Talmud source that calls Jesus a sorcerer. Yeah. It's just very interesting. Go ahead, Steve.
Yeah, is there a skeptic's answer to the later conversion of a man named Saul who became Paul? What would be the motive for him to have picked up this mantle of Jesus Christ, who would have been one of the best witnesses for a resurrected Christ, mm-hmm, of anyone? How do people argue that Paul's conversion isn't something that's based on the evidence of a risen Savior? Because that's the basis for his not having followed Christ, but having been converted to Christ by Christ.
Yeah, that's a good point. I don't think I've ever had that precise conversation with someone, so I couldn't tell you, but I would think it's probably along some of the same lines of the things we've been talking about.